You're listening to WRUU-LP, Savannah, Georgia, 107.5 FM, WRUU.org. We are Savannah Soundings, community radio with global soul.
Check, check, one, two. Look like a little country. Rock and roll and blues. Cause we sure love playing for good people like you. Let me know if you can hear me. Check, check, one, two.
You are listening to Savannah Music Local and Sustainable, the radio show that features conversations with and the music of local musicians and traveling musicians performing in town. I'm your host, Dave Lake. Tonight on Savannah Music Local and Sustainable, I'm talking with pianist Cameron Furman. I met up with Cameron when she did a performance for donors to Bach Ascending. And her performance was based upon the idea that there are multiple ways to do Bach and other Baroque composers on the piano, because that music was not written for the piano. And I was so impressed that I had to have her on the show. So welcome to Savannah Music Local and Sustainable, Cameron Furman.
Thank you.
And so let's get to know Cameron Furman. Tell me your musical journey.
So I always loved playing the piano. My older sister was a pianist, and I wanted to do everything she did. So that was my primary motivation for getting into it. I grew up in rural Central Oregon, really enjoyed playing, but didn't think I would make a profession out of it because it just felt really risky. So I went to college in Michigan, Hillsdale College, and thought I might major in math. And turned out I really loved music. So I got into theory. I went to Eastman for graduate school, actually initially for theory, but missed playing so much that I switched to the piano track and haven't looked back.
When you were young and learning the piano, I'm sure you had private lessons.
Yes.
And all the music that you played was undoubtedly the range of dead white male composers.
Primarily, you know, I think some of the more 20th century composers altered from that small section of composers a little bit, but yes, primarily dead white males.
And did your sister pursue music as well?
You know, she ended up not. She did classics, Latin and Greek, in the end.
And you mentioned Central Oregon. Which side of the Cascades?
The eastern side, so high desert.
Oh. Mm-hmm. Then you went to Hillsdale College in Michigan.
Yes.
Why?
Well, my sister was there. But no, it's a great little liberal arts school, and since I wasn't entirely sure what I wanted to do, I knew it would give me a good education in how to think and how to live a considered life, whatever I ended up doing. So.
And so you were considering mathematics?
I was. I always loved math. I loved the structure of it and the systems that it involves a lot.
Well, you probably wouldn't be surprised the number of musicians I've talked to who like math, often
yes.
Majored in math, or majored in math and physics.
Yeah, they go together, don't they?
And so you then eventually changed to a music major?
I did, yeah. I had a really phenomenal theory professor there who used theory to show us ways of thinking about music, ways of hearing music, ways of playing music, rather than, you know, making theory something that's quite divorced from the actual performance of music. So I really loved that, and that's how I got into theory, at any rate.
And so that was your major?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And then you went to graduate school at Eastman, and there you started in theory, but you love the piano, and so you changed to piano performance.
I did, yeah.
And so your graduate degrees are in piano performance.
They are. I did my first master's in theory and then a master's in piano and a doctorate in piano.
And so tell me a little bit about what goes into a theory major.
It depends, of course, on the place, but for instance, my graduate work at Eastman was focused on theory pedagogy. So the bulk of my work was on how to teach theory well, various ways of teaching theory, but one of the things that that program did well was also made sure you had a substantial deep background in theory itself, right? And not just in you know, the sort of basic core principles, but in the more advanced topics as well. So, you know, we took a lot of Shankarian theory, sonata theory, the list goes on. But it was a great, great program. I think Aceman has a really unique thing going there. And I think for me, what I found was that the actual process of being a theory major required a little more abstraction than what I loved about theory, and that a lot of the work that you needed to do didn't necessarily have a very direct correlation to how you might play the piece. And that's what makes me so excited. I love how performance and theory go hand in hand and inform each other. So I decided it would be easier and more successful to be a pianist who also had a strong background in theory than to be a theorist who could kind of play the piano. It would give me more of the life that I wanted.
How does theory differ from, say, composition, mm-hmm. where theory is an important part of it? On the end, many schools, even in theory, you'll be asked to compose.
Right, right.
To use those principles.
Yeah, for sure. So composition is more the act of creating new music, right? And I think often, I mean, I wasn't a composition major, but my understanding is for composition majors, they're often searching for new ways of saying something. Whereas in theory, you're looking for ways of explaining or of tracking the systems that make already composed music work, that make them come together into a cohesive and successful piece of art. So you're analyzing rather than creating.
And undoubtedly, you would talk about the various periods of music in theory, because it greatly varied.
Yes.
And although the basics are the same, as I was talking to a composer, and I said, you know, as a composer of new music, and he says, I don't use that term because I use the same notes that Mozart used.
That's true.
And so there's principles that carry over mm-hmm. from period to period to period, but there are dramatic changes in terms of theoretical constructs from the Baroque period, even into the classical period,
into
the Romantic period, and then in the 20th century.
All hell breaks loose.
Exactly.
Yes.
It's do as you want to do, I think.
Yeah.
And since it is so, the 20th century, particularly since maybe the 80s mm-hmm. and into the 90s, where American music schools have moved away from strictly atonal mm-hmm. music, which dominated American music schools probably in the 30s, 40s, 50s,
right.
60s, 70s, has opened up a plethora of directions that people can take as a modern composer.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Which I would think would put even more emphasis than on knowing all the theory of all the different periods to apply that to composition.
Yeah, for sure. I think especially since one of the main avenues that I think composition has taken in the last 50 years or so is a more retrospective look. You know, people bringing elements of the classical style or the Baroque style into their compositions and, you know, making it their own. So understanding kind of the full scope of Western music composition lets you understand what contemporary composers are doing, I think, much better.
Well, and that is sort of the basis of your presentation that you made at the reception for donors to Bach Ascending.
Yes.
Because it was based upon the theoretical constructs of Baroque music, mm-hmm. mostly.
Mostly.
Your premise was the fact that a lot in Baroque music is not stated.
Right.
And so that gives actually a lot of freedom, potentially, to the musician.
It does.
Particularly a pianist.
Yes.
Could you expand upon that?
Yeah, so as a pianist, we're playing an instrument that wasn't around in the Baroque era. So yes, by the late Baroque era, the pianoforte had been invented, but it was such a different instrument than the piano is now that there really, you know, there isn't a direct comparison there. So when you're trying to play these broke works for keyboard that were originally written for harpsichord, clavichord, organ, and put them onto the piano, it really is almost like a kind of transcription. You have a different instrument with different capacities. So that gives you some freedom, I think some additional freedom to interpret what this composer might have been envisioning. So they might have been going for this effect on harpsichord. How can I achieve that on the piano? Or is there another effect that I could get on the piano that wouldn't have been possible on the harpsichord that is musically successful? You know, so it just gives you even more options, I think, to consider.
And what are the differences between the piano and the harpsichord?
Many, many and varied. The primary one is probably the mode of making sound, right? So a harpsichord plucks the string, whereas in the piano you have a damper that hits the string. The piano has easier access to dynamic changes. So you can, contrary to some opinion, you can create crescendos and diminuendos on the harpsichord, but it's through a very, very different process. It's through adding more notes to just create a bigger block of sound, that kind of a thing. Whereas on piano, you can take a line of single notes like a scale. You can make it louder gradually. You can make it gradually softer. You have the damper pedal on a piano, which is a way of making notes sustain, not to the extent that an organ can do, but much more than a harpsichord can do. You have more notes on a piano. You have a lot more resonance in a piano. You have the ability to cut notes off actually faster on a piano probably than you do on a harpsichord. So I think there's easier access to a really wide range of lengths and dynamics, in addition to just a different tone quality, right? You're talking about plucking on the harpsichord, which is a very distinct sound, versus almost a more percussive, but yet can become more songful hitting on the piano.
And so let's talk then about the major features which you illustrated in your presentation. We'll go through your presentation in its entirety.
Okay.
But I want to focus on some of those aspects that you brought up. One of the aspects that you just mentioned was volume.
Mm-hmm.
That the piano, it's actually called the pianoforte.
Right. Yes.
Because piano is quiet and forte is loud.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And it's called that because that's what it can do. It
mm-hmm.
can be soft and it can be loud.
Yes.
Unlike the harpsichord. It can't be loud.
Right.
It can
right.
be louder.
Yes.
But it can't
yes.
be loud.
Loud. Right.
In that sense. By doing things like multiple hitting of the same note
mm-hmm.
on the different registers, for instance.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But this allowed a great expansion of dynamics
yeah.
of the music. Could you do a piece from the Baroque and demonstrate those dynamic changes that you can make on the piano that you can't do on the harpsichord?
Sure. Yes, absolutely. Do you have a preference as to piece?
No.
No? All right. Would you like one performance of it that has a lot of dynamic variance or two performances that use different dynamic levels?
How about two performances?
Okay.
One that would mimic what you can do on the harpsichord on the piano.
Okay.
And then do what the piano can do.
All right. Sounds good. So this will be, how about a Sarabande from Handel's Suite in A Major.
Thank you.
The other thing you mentioned was that there are no tempo markings,
yes.
or very few tempo markings.
Yes.
Now, some pieces are generally played in a certain manner.
Mm-hmm.
We'll take the Allemande. We'll be later talking about a suite.
Mm-hmm.
And a typical part of a Baroque suite is the Allemande. And the Allemande is traditionally quite slow. Sometimes it's almost ponderous. It's so slow.
It can be.
So, and rarely played fast,
mm-hmm.
if ever. On the other hand, a gigue is always fast.
Right.
So some things are traditionally different tempi.
Mm-hmm.
But you have tempo flexibility.
You do.
Particularly because of rubato.
Mm-hmm.
So that you can change it as you are feeling it.
Mm-hmm.
As the piece goes through, the way that it sort of feels to you may change in terms of its tempo.
Right.
Very often, what you'll find is a relatively quick tempo throughout the piece, and then it could be a diminuendo. It could be both slowing as well as getting quieter
mm-hmm.
at the end,
mm-hmm.
or simply a slowing at the end.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And very, very common.
Yeah.
Now, that is not marked.
No, it is not.
But you hear it quite commonly.
Mm-hmm. It is.
So you have that flexibility.
For sure. Yes. Yes. And I think, you know, even with Baroque pieces that don't have a specific dance associated with them, there often was an understanding, given the time signature that was given or the note values that were written, of approximately what the tempo would be. But still, within that, there's a lot of variety. And again, given that we are in a different instrument, the piano, with different capacities, that can make different tempos work than might have worked on a harpsichord or organ.
And there are some performers who are famous for or infamous for making modifications of Baroque music.
Absolutely.
The name Glenn Gould comes immediately to mind.
It does.
And he was criticized strongly for expressing himself and his feelings
mm-hmm.
on the palette of Bach.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And I think, you know, it's a tricky thing to talk about as a performer, because I think that our goal isn't, or at least shouldn't be, to make the music about showing us. You know, it's not about my ego, about putting that on display. But if we're trying to give an honest reading of the music we're playing, you know, kind of do the best service to it that we can with all the resources and experience and personality that we have at our disposal, we are going to create a unique reading of it, you know, that will have our personality in it. And sometimes people won't like that. And sometimes it may not be true at all to how they would have, you know, played a piece in the time that it was written. That doesn't mean that it can't have value and that it can't make a impactful and worthwhile musical statement.
Could you give us an example of the Handel, for instance,
mm-hmm.
in terms of changing the tempo as you go through the piece? Now, what you did
sure.
in terms of the performances before, particularly the first one,
mm-hmm.
was pretty even in terms of a tempo.
Mm-hmm.
Not much tempo variation. Could you give it a feeling of you that may result in a change of tempo of that piece?
Sure, sure.
Thank you.
Now, as you were playing through, you had the notes of a melody, mm-hmm. but then there were these extra things thrown in. I think they're called ornaments.
Yes, sir.
So what are some examples of ornaments?
So there's, in the Baroque period, generally the French school of ornaments and the Italian school of ornaments. So the French school is generally what we think of when we're talking about ornaments. The trills, mordants, or sometimes that kind of thing. You can also have appoggiaturas, so rather than maybe going straight to this note, I might add a little sigh before it. The Italian school of ornaments was often more diminutions, so creating little scale passages between two notes, or adding an arpeggio to a note rather than using a single note. And, you know, they're used in multiple ways, but some of the main ways are as expression. You know, you can add a certain character to a note through the ornament you choose, or you can also add metric weight to a note through an ornament, give it a little bit more emphasis and therefore clarify what the meter's doing in the music.
Now, there has been a movement since, I'll say, the 50s, if you really want to stretch the point, mm-hmm. but really since about the 70s, mm-hmm. of trying to be as Baroque as possible.
Sure, yeah.
To honor the music as perhaps it was played originally. Mm-hmm. And so they've relied upon the various treatises that have been come down to us, but there's only been a very small number of those. Mm-hmm. And so the interpretation that they give is based upon those treatises, so those opinions of what Baroque music should be. Mm-hmm. Now, do you think, back in the Baroque time, that Baroque musicians followed very strict rules?
That's a tricky question in a way, because I do think there was a definite sense of style and what was stylistic that was, you know, just transmitted consciously and unconsciously just through listening. But I also think there was a ton of freedom. So there was not a set strict of rules in the sense of, on this kind of note, you must use this ornament. There would be a lot of options for ornaments for that note. Or in this particular area, you must use this set of couplings on the harpsichord. No, a lot of that was up to the performer's choice, for sure. Articulations. Again, there were certain things that probably wouldn't even have occurred to them to do because they were so far outside the stylistic norm. But within what would have occurred to them, there was a lot of freedom and a lot of different options of things that could work well.
And that is what made a virtuoso versus your run-of-the-mill harpsichord player.
Right, yeah, yeah.
And in a sense, if you think about it, these musicians, and particularly musician-composers, which was a very common thing back in the Baroque period.
For sure.
Were improvisers.
Yes.
I mean, they really did a lot of improvisation.
Definitely.
And so they were literally the jazz players of the 17th century.
Yeah.
Or 18th century. So there's a lot to the music that goes beyond a simple playing of the notes.
Definitely.
And although Baroque music perhaps has a bad rep, because it's often played quite plainly. Mm-hmm. You can put a lot of inspiration into it.
You definitely can. I think that, you know, I can only speak for what I know during my lifetime. But during my lifetime, at least, in student world, there is a certain fear of Baroque music because I think we tend to be afraid that we're not going to play it right. And I'm not entirely sure where this idea of there being more of a right way to play Baroque music than any other era came from, but I suspect maybe it is through some of this performance practice knowledge trickling down and teachers, you know, perhaps not having a full idea of what goes into it, which is fair. It's hard to, you know all the aspects of every era you're playing, but feeling like, oh, there are rules for this. We have to follow these rules that I heard this one time. But in actuality, like you said, the rules are flexible. And it would be impossible, in any case, to replicate exactly what was going on in the Baroque era, even if you had the same instruments, right? Just because as listeners, we've heard a lot more. The venues we use are different. Our ears have developed differently, right? So there is so much space for creativity.
This is WRUULP, Savannah, Georgia, 107.5 FM, WRUU.org. We are Savannah Soundings, community radio with global soul.
You're listening to WRUU, your local radio station, for people just like you, hosted by people from your community. The voices you hear are your neighbors, coworkers, and others from the Savannah and Lowcountry area. In other words, WRUU is your community radio station. Please help us by donating whatever you can to help your neighbors and friends stay on the air. Go to WRUU.org and support your local radio station. Any amount is welcomed. Thank you for your support of WRUU.
Bach Ascending presents the Atlanta Baroque Orchestra in a performance of J.S. Bach's Ascending Oratorio BWV 11 and more on Sunday, April 19th at 4 p.m. at the Lutheran Church of the Ascension, 120 Bull Street, Savannah, in Wright Square. This is an exclusive Savannah performance in celebration of the Lutheran Church of the Ascension's 285th anniversary. More information and tickets are available at bachascending.com. This music is often called classical music, but remember, Mozart, Beethoven, and Liszt were the rock stars of their time, so I simply call it great music. I'm your host, Dave Lake, and join me for four centuries of great music, with new episodes each week on Sundays from 3 to 5 p.m. We also have encores of these episodes on Saturdays from 3 to 5 p.m. from mid-June to early December. Welcome back to Music Local and Sustainable, and I'm your host, Dave Lake. Tonight on Savannah Music Local and Sustainable, I'm talking with pianist Cameron Furman. I met up with Cameron when she did a performance for donors to Bach Ascending, and her performance was based upon the idea that there are multiple ways to do Bach and other Baroque composers on the piano, because that music was not written for the piano. And I was so impressed that I had to have her on the show. So with that introduction, let's listen to the presentation that you gave at the reception.
Like I said, growing up, I think there was a feeling I had, and all of the students I was aware of also had, that Baroque music was constricting, that you had to try to play it the right way. But no one I ever met could tell me what that one right way was exactly. So there was sort of this idea that you just tried not to do too much of anything with Baroque music so as not to offend anyone. And I think it is one of several reasons why students, even now, tend to not gravitate towards Baroque music. You know, it just kind of feels like you're in a little bit of a straitjacket. And my approach towards Baroque music really started to change when I started getting more information about not only how it was played, but kind of where it was coming from and the attitudes around it when it was being written. So probably what changed my view of Baroque music the most was looking into the dance suite, right? Which is a set of Baroque dances that were paired together, usually with the same tonic, so all in, say, A, A major, A minor, or D, D major, D minor. And there were some aspects of this suite that were pretty well codified by the end of the Baroque with Bach, you know, like the order that some of them would come in. You would pretty much always have an Allemande as your first dance, Courant as second, Sarabande as third. Then you get more flexibility. You could add some gavottes or rondos or bourrées or minuets, you know, there was some variety. And then at least the German suites would usually end with a gigue. In the French suites, it was at least as commonly to be a variation set of some sort. as I started to learn more about Baroque music outside of Germany, you know, which is kind of rare for students because we pretty much only play the German Baroques, namely Bach, who is great, but there was so much else going on during that era. So as I started to learn more about French Baroque music and understand that two of the main motivating factors or catalysts for music in France at that time were dance and drama, my idea of Baroque music became much, much more vibrant. And I think, not to say by any means that there isn't life and drama and emotion in German Baroque music, but I think it's a little bit more easily accessible, easy to see in the French Baroque in general. So I started reading through so much French keyboard music, especially the dance suites, and just the range of emotions that were there, the range of storytelling that was in it, was remarkable to me. So one aspect of French dance music that's different than the German dance music is that the French suites often use sort of character titles. So rather than just calling an Allemande, they would often give it a descriptive name. So you have these dances that are called things like Cyclops or the Villager or the Whirlwind or Three Hands, if it's especially virtuosic, that kind of a thing. And there's just this sense of fun and of extroversion, I think, that suddenly clicked for me when I was playing this French dance music, that gave me a really different idea of Baroque keyboard music in general. Another thing that I discovered when I was sort of learning about these suites is that they're not set in stone. So, for example, if we took, you know, one of the classical sonatas, say Mozart, Beethoven, we probably wouldn't mix and match movements. You know, we wouldn't say, I don't really like the second movement of this sonata, I'm going to exchange it for a different second movement, right? We maintain the integrity of what the composer wrote. And we treat Baroque dance suites the same way, generally. But to some degree, during the Baroque era, they didn't do that. They would only play part of the suite if they only had a little bit of time, or they might add movements to the suite that were in the same key if they had more time, or they might say, I don't like the Allemande, I'm going to switch it out for a different one. You know, that was something that was accepted and to a certain extent expected, to alter the suite to fit the environment you're playing it in. And that was a little bit revolutionary to me. You know, it really shook this idea I think we have of the score as this sacred thing that, you know, we cannot touch, we cannot mess with, we cannot alter, we cannot presume to add anything to or change anything about. And it helped me see Baroque music as much more of a living thing that is still kind of in the process of being created, in a sense. And then throughout my education, I was exposed to quite a wide spectrum of approaches to Baroque music, and crucially, I was exposed to them done very well. So, especially in my graduate work, I was very fortunate to be in circumstances where it was really, really easy to learn about performance practice. You know, I had access to really, truly some of the top researchers on this and top performers of it, you know, that really followed this idea that there's so much we can learn from the treatises, that understanding how Baroque musicians play Baroque music can give us so much insight into what makes this music come alive, what makes it tick. And I learned a ton, and it was so exciting. I am immensely grateful for that. One of the things that was very striking to me was that these people who were literally some of the very top in their field in this performance practice idea were also the ones who were fastest to say, but you know, do what you like. Do what works for your instrument. You know, experiment. Try it different ways. You know, you can do it a different way every time. And that was very impactful for me because it was not about, well, you have to follow this rule because that's what this treatise says. It was about, okay, well, generally understand the style and then take that into account as you are working on your instrument with your goal. So we had the performance practice experts on one side. On the other side, I had my primary piano teacher who really, it's perhaps an exaggeration to say she wasn't interested at all in performance practice, but it just wasn't part of her life, her music making. And she was very much of a school that took Baroque music on the piano as an opportunity to make the piano shine. Use the piano to its full expressive range. Really doesn't matter if it's not something they would have done in the Baroque, you know, your articulation or your use of pedal, you know, just make it sound gorgeous on the piano. And my goodness, she can make it sound gorgeous on the piano, right? It's beautiful. So I was swimming in graduate school, especially in this world of very different approaches to Baroque music and a whole sort of range in between, all done so well and so convincingly. And all of this put together, kind of understanding the life in Baroque music, understanding that it is still kind of something in creation, and understanding that there is a really wide range of ways to play it that are musically valid and that bring different aspects to it and that highlight different aspects of it, gave me so much more freedom and interest in playing Baroque music. You know, especially since I'm, you know, no longer in the stage of my career where I'm doing competitions, you know, where I'm going to be judged on, like, whether someone approves of my choices. I find Baroque music the place where I have probably the most freedom, the most opportunity to just say, well, let's try this. You know, I might not like it tomorrow, but let's try it today. Let's go way to the performance practice side on this piece, and let's go way to the sort of just use piano as the full modern day instrument it is on the other side. And just being able to play with that, and I think have a playfulness with that, is wonderful for me, and something that is often kind of rare in the classical piano world, where we are a very stressed out bunch. So I have found Baroque music to be a really excellent outlet in that way. One other thing that's worth noting as we aim towards the playing side of this presentation is that the school of thought that uses the piano, as the full modern day instrument with Baroque music, in the earlier 20th century, there were a lot of performers who would take this quite far, and they would actually, to some degree, rewrite Bach or these Baroque composers to make it more idiomatic on the piano. So that could be adding notes, or it could be, you know, just enriching harmonies or using new registers. And one of the performers slash composers who took this the furthest was the Italian Busoni. He transcribed a lot of Baroque music, especially Bach, and made it kind of into these romantic era masterpieces of the piano. So in the music I'll be playing today, we'll start with a prelude, which Baroque dance suites often did, prelude by Bach from the Second English Suite. We'll go to an Allemande by the French composer Jean-Philippe Rameau, and the Courant will be by Böhm. The Sarabande is by Handel. Then we get to the portion of the suite where we have a little bit more flexibility, so we'll do a Gavotte and Variation by Pachelbel. And then I'll add one of those transcriptions by Busoni. So this is actually a arrangement of a Lutheran chorale that Bach made for organ. So he took this Lutheran chorale, made an arrangement for it basically on organ, and then Busoni took that organ arrangement and adapted it for the piano. And then to end, rather than doing a gigue, I will play a movement from a sonata by C.P.E. Bach, who is Bach's probably most successful composer son. And while not a gigue, it very much has that upbeat and energetic character of a gigue.
Thank you.
tonight on Savannah Music Local and Sustainable, I've been talking with Cameron Furman. And as you've heard, she is a marvelous pianist, but also a wonderful educator, sharing with us the music of the Baroque era from a unique Cameron Furman perspective. I want to thank you so very much, Cameron, for being on the show tonight.
Thank you so much for having me.
This has been another edition of Music Local and Sustainable, and I've been your host, Dave Lake. Save this time for another show next week.
Well, I know we ain't headed for the Hall of Fame. Gonna give it what we got, man, it ain't no shame. Let me know if you can hear me. Check, check, one, two. Let me know if you can hear me. Check, check, one, two.